Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. The world around us is constantly changing. Out with the old and in with the new, as the saying goes. Whether it be a new building, a new phone, or a new road, we constantly want the newer, better thing. But when we're constantly pushing out the old in favor of the new, what do we lose? What do we lose when we get rid of the old? This week on the podcast, even though we here may be young, we're taking a look at the old. All that and more here on Real College Podcast. Like so many other big cities in America, Minneapolis and St. Paul are currently going through a construction boom. Old buildings are being torn down left and right to be replaced with larger, newer, swankier buildings. And whether you're for or against this trend, you've doubtless looked at one of these old buildings slated to be torn down and thought to yourself, I wonder what that place's story is. Of course, every building has a story and a history to go along with it. And some of these are worth preserving. Ben Hallam has more.
It's a common joke throughout the Upper Midwest to say that there's two seasons, winter and construction. And if you walk around downtown Minneapolis during these hot summer months, you'll know that for a fact. But as all the new buildings go up throughout the Twin Cities, someone's got to keep track of the old buildings, the buildings that connect us to our collective past here in Minneapolis. To find out more about historic preservation in the city of Minneapolis, I talked to Jason Wittenberg, Manager of Land Use, Design, and Preservation in the Community Planning and Economic Development Department of the city government.
To start with, what exactly is heritage preservation? What does it mean for a building or location to be designated with a heritage preservation designation?
Sure, and there are different levels of historic designation. There's actually a National Register of Historic Places. Many people are familiar with that term. There's a state level of designation, and what we primarily deal with at the city, of course, is local designation. Properties that are either designated as local historic landmarks or are in local historic districts. And we have, I believe we're at currently 17 local historic districts in the city of Minneapolis and over 170 landmarks that are locally designated. So what that does is provides a level of protection from demolition or significant alteration as kind of a recognition that this landmark or this district is important to our community's kind of shared heritage and our understanding of what our city is and has been in the past.
And so how does the process of something becoming a designated heritage landmark begin on the local level? What's usually the impetus for something that would reach your office or reach the Heritage Preservation Commission?
We have hired consultants to essentially do surveys of communities throughout the city to identify preliminarily potential historic resources based on their cultural attributes or architecture and so forth. So that's sort of our starting point of identifying potential properties. And if somebody comes in for a demolition permit, we review every one of those demolition permits for tearing down a building to determine whether a building that is slated for demolition could be a potential or is a potential historic resource and should be further evaluated. The city council or the mayor or members of the Heritage Preservation Commission or our department can initiate a designation study as well. There's a nomination process where property is placed under what's called interim protection, and that building or district is kind of temporarily protected while we do further study of whether the district or landmark meets the ordinance criteria for designation as a landmark. And then there's a public hearing process. The Heritage Preservation Commission and City Council and Mayor ultimately decide whether to designate something as a landmark.
What are some of the criteria which a building might need to fulfill in order to be designated as a landmark? Or could you give an example of talking about how a building has fulfilled or not fulfilled those criteria?
Sure. And we've been making a particular effort to designate properties that are associated with groups that have historically been underrepresented in the preservation world. So one of the first African-American churches in the city of Minneapolis, which would meet the criterion related to cultural significance. There are 7 different criteria related to architecture or engineering significance or cultural significance. And if a property meets any one of those criteria, it could potentially be designated.
What are some of the benefits of historic designation? I mean, what can a historic designation bring to a community?
It helps us have kind of a shared understanding of our common heritage from a public kind of purpose standpoint. From the standpoint of a property owner who has a building that is considered for designation, there are definitely trade-offs there. Some people are concerned about that extra layer of regulation that might bring to their property. They have original windows in the building. That may be a significant process and time and expense in order to replace windows or siding or roofing materials or that kind of thing. However, there can be financial benefits. For example, it does open up the possibility that tax credits can be used to help fund improvements to a locally designated or nationally designated property.
Can there be any other drawbacks to the historical preservation process or things you need to weigh when you're considering whether to have a building preserved?
There's a line to be drawn somewhere about how kind of special a project has to be in order to be a landmark, because we have a lot of really interesting buildings and areas throughout the city. But as some people have said, if everything is special and rises to the level of preservation, then is anything really that special? I mean, for designation, it really has to be something that is particularly interesting or exemplary of a particular architecture or cultural phenomenon that kind of rises above the standard run-of-the-mill, for lack of a better term, buildings or districts in the city.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about the HBC or about historic preservation in Minneapolis?
Right now, one thing that might be actually of interest to Radio K listeners is that we're doing a Minneapolis music history study where we're looking at properties that may be significant in the history of Minneapolis music from 1850 through the end of the 20th century and identifying which of those properties might be worthy of kind of further study and eventual historic designation. We're trying to look beyond kind of the typical things that people think of for historic designation in a city like Minneapolis, where, you know, Victorian houses are what people think of often when they think of historic designation in a larger city like Minneapolis. But we're trying to think more broadly about cultural criteria as well, because those are also important as kind of a shared understanding of our history.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
There's nothing older or more constantly evolving than nature. And yet, because of climate change and human development, nature is being forced to find new ways to survive and cope in the world. Producer Nathan Fervoy looks at how one group is keeping track of new patterns being developed by butterflies here in Minnesota.
A crushed salamander or something on the road. Why do they come? Why do they come to coyote droppings? They're males. What they're coming down is they're sipping what they can dissolve out of the coyote droppings. They're trying to pick up sodium. When they mate with a female, they pass as much sodium in what they call a spermatophore, which is sort of a packet of sperm and sodium. They pass that to the female. She uses that sodium to produce her eggs. So the butterfly that can sip the most sodium off of a coyote scat will have the most offspring after me. So there's a reason. It's not a singles bar.
My name is Dean Hansen. I trained as an entomologist, mostly worked on aquatic insects, but I got into doing surveys for the DNR, so look for butterflies on Camp Ripley and other places. Look for prairie obligate butterflies, jumping spiders, tiger beetles, and then I just get out on my own a lot. I like to go up to Fish Lake State Wildlife Area and Crex Meadows in Burnett County, Wisconsin, Namekagon Barrens, and just get out in the natural world and see how many butterflies I can see and photograph.
My name is Dorothy Waltz, and I'm a member of St. Paul Audubon Society, and this is my volunteer activity for them.
Well, like, what makes you come out here, and what do you enjoy about coming out and counting butterflies?
Well, I'm no expert on butterflies. As you know, I'm basically the one who organizes the volunteers and signs them up. But just being out here, because there's the birds, there's the butterflies, there's the dragonflies. It's just a marvelous habitat to be roaming around in, and you don't get to do it very often.
Sure, yeah.
Interesting, there's a little, two little nests. I've never seen one before. It's like some kind of a mud daubing wasp has made these little nests on it. This is last year's big blue stem or Indian grass. So interesting. Well, let's swing on up and get down almost noon.
Yeah, and you mentioned that it seemed to you like there was a decrease in the past few years.
It's funny. I guess I'd have to go over and look at things, but I just today I just said, "Where's everything? I'm seeing blossoms, seeing black-eyed Susans out, a common milkweed, a butterfly milkweed, and basically no butterflies nectaring." It just seems that in years past we stopped counting eastern tail blues because they're all over the place, and we saw one. So it just seems that. Numbers, both numbers of individuals and numbers of species seem to be decreasing.
He thinks, because he's been coming out and doing this for over 20 years here, and he's seeing a real difference in how many butterflies we see.
A decline.
Yeah. And so I'm going to go back and go through our records and send him reports from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, so he can see, has it really been changing as much as he thinks it has, or are we just not remembering well?
Well, sadly, I think I'm seeing a loss of interest in the natural world. I grew up along Minnehaha Creek in South Minneapolis. People in the same area now, maybe kids would grow up more time in front of a computer screen rather than playing in the creek. So, I sadly see an almost an antipathy toward the natural world. You know, people, bug. You know, people disliking insects, disliking. I'm sorry, I could go on and on about that. So I'll just stop. I think people are getting divorced from the natural world, and kids that were growing up on a dairy farm in 1950. That's a very different farm from what a 3,000 acre corn and soybean farm is today. It's not the same. I go into Google Earth, go down by Worthington, and I see an entire section, it's an entire square mile. There's a 320 acre cornfield, and then there are 260 almost acre soybean fields, and a little acre or two where the house and the barn are. And it's just an entire square mile. And they're two species of plants on the whole thing. I think it's concerning, really, really, really concerning. And it's industrialized agriculture. No more red clover fields. No more forage crops. It's a
160 acres of corn or 320 acres of corn, and we're just replacing a variety of agricultural crops with monocultures, and the corn and soybeans. That's it. That's concerning. There's no habitat for butterflies, no habitat for birds, no habitat for the things I love, and the things in the natural world.
In high school, I did a lot of backpacking trips, like over the summers, and just like always thought natural places were really amazing and needed to be appreciated and used and conserved. And so that's probably that. And then butterflies are just, they're just like really cool insects. And whenever I like tell anyone about Butterfly Club or like that I'm into butterflies, they're like, oh my god, I love butterflies. And it's just like, it's a great way to connect with people. Just like butterflies and like natural things.
Dean was being all like depressed about like the state of the world.
Yeah, he got really cynical.
What do you think about that?
Well, I didn't hear exactly what he was saying, but it's definitely true that like a lot of people in the younger generation like don't seem to appreciate or be aware of the changes in the world. Like, it's really easy knowing and accepting that like crazy weather patterns are just like gonna happen, and that's fine, but like it didn't always used to be like that, and there weren't always like a bunch of 100 degree days and a bunch of like negative 40 degree days. Like, things are changing. It's easy to not realize that when you're young.
Butterfly Club. Tell us about Butterfly Club.
Yeah, it's just a lot of people who are into sustainability and conservation, specifically of butterflies, but for all things, all natural things. And yeah, we just like promote the appreciation and enjoyment of butterflies through various activities.
Well, basically everyone can agree that buildings and nature are things worth protecting. Books might not be something that comes to your mind when you think of something old needing of protection. And yet with the rise of new technology like e-readers, old books are starting to disappear. Luckily, though, groups have arisen with the mission of trading, protecting, and discussing antique books. Ben Hallam has more.
In the digital age, accessing the newest literature can be as easy as going online or going onto whatever e-reader app you prefer. But the old books still remain, and their physical presence is still felt. To find out more about the importance of these old books, of books as physical objects, I talked to Eric Lorber, Executive Director of Rain Taxi Review of Books and Manager of the Print Matters Book Festival in Minneapolis.
All right, and we're here to talk today about the Print Matters Book Fair, and we're talking a couple days before it comes up, but can you just give us a little bit of an overview of what the Print Matters Book Fair is and where it's taking place?
Sure. For decades, there's been an antiquarian book fair taking place here in the Twin Cities. That used to be a really bustling activity, but as the internet crept in and, you know, things changed a little bit, that crowd got smaller and smaller. But we really love it because the old books are how we all got into books. You know, there weren't digital books around when we were kids, for example. So we just wanted to try to reinvigorate it by broadening it out a little bit and reminding people print matters, that it is something that not only creates these material objects that are so beautiful and sensual and pleasurable to look at and hold and touch and read and use, but that it really does matter for our culture to be attentive to art as object and not just art as idea.
So reading is usually like, I mean, it's an isolated activity. Even going around in a bookstore can be an isolated activity. So how does the book fair then play into that and kind of creating like the social space for print media and things like that?
I mean, I think that one aspect of it is that book lovers definitely like to see other people like them out in the wild. And there's something cool about people itching to look at the same shelf maybe, or get into that section of the alphabet, or just sharing insights and observations with each other as they browse. It is a kind of socializing aspect to what you say is usually a solitary pleasure. The book fair element creates a kind of platform for interaction, if we're going to use the current terminology.
What do you think draws people to get into looking and browsing for these antique books? What kind of pleasure do people take from antique books stealing, antique books collecting, and that sort of thing?
Well, I should say, first of all, it's not just antique books. It really is a broader... For example, there's one of the dealers specializes in rock posters and prints from the 60s and 70s, and I wouldn't necessarily think of that as an antique type thing, but it is a cool thing that happens in the print medium. Another dealer has a specialty in like punk zines and that kind of stuff. So again, I just think it is a broader category than most people think when they hear old or rare or antique book. But back to your question, I think the pleasure is that some of these things, first of all, are fairly limited, that they didn't really make that many copies of them. And then the condition comes in. The better the condition, the more rare it even is. So there's a pleasure at seeing that something has survived and that somebody took care of it. And I think part of that pleasure is that, oh, I could be the next person to take care of this thing.
I think when you think of like antique books, you think of like a musty old library, but it's kind of just a collection of like American history, or like just printed artifacts from all time. Or what do you say?
I would say not just American history, almost cosmic history and inner and outer space. To me, books are an expression of culture, expression of people's desires, their ideas of beauty, their intellect, their thoughts. They really are almost an extension of humanity's being, you know, rather than something totally functional. To me, that's the part in which they might be from a different time, but they're definitely not musty or irrelevant, or if you're tuning into like what that represents, then they can feel as relevant now as before. For example, one of the dealers is bringing an old mushroom hunter's guide. Maybe on one hand it's out of date, or they have new scientific discoveries or new names or something, but on the other hand it's like, wow, it's cool, these old illustrations, or it comes with like a viewfinder, or like all this kind of stuff into how people did mushroom hunting 100 years ago. That's just cool.
And what would you say as to like the importance of treating books as like a physical art object in the digital era?
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways to treat them, I think. So I feel like there are some books that are meant to be passed around and dog-eared and shared, really used till you almost can't use it anymore, till you're holding it together with a rubber band. And then there are other books that are meant to be like, ah, I gotta keep that one intact so that it lasts, so that it preserves its own being in the world, you know? And I think that, like, again, you can do both with books. You can choose, and in that sense you have a relationship with them. You're part of their life. It's not just an object that is in your life. You're a part of its life, and it's a part of your life. There's something really magical about that, if it's a book that you personally connect with.
What is the importance of a book fair that's specifically focusing on used books and old books, and what's the role of like the used book market versus like the new book market and new book festival?
Well, one reason we got into doing this Print Matter show in the summer is because we already do the Twin Cities Book Festival every fall, and that festival is all about new books and new publishers, authors who have just written a book that year, people giving talks and lectures and panels. But the focus on used material creates an awareness of how object-oriented and how finite it really is. Some of the books, for example, are artist books. They were actually made by artists, so they're really limited. We have that there too. So it's not necessarily about being old. I think it's as much about being an aspect of a time or a community or a cultural idea. Yeah, so for me, that's what's really exciting about having an entire show that's focused on that element. It's about having an experience. Kind of connecting over this culture of books and print objects it's a reminder that we need to keep crisscrossing with other people to experience our world.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
Well, that is it for Real College Podcast this week. Thanks to Ben and Nathan, whose stories you heard this week. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It is produced by Liv Riggins, Ben Hallam, and Nathan Fervoy. I, Alex Schumacher, am your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found at the one, the only, RadioK.org or on iTunes. That is all for Real College Podcast this week. See you around.